Thank you very much. Good morning. I appreciate your having me today. How many people live in states where the governors or the legislatures have considered making the HPV vaccine mandatory? Good number of you. And how many people live in states where the vaccine actually is mandatory? I think it's Virginia and DC. Is there any other place? Okay, that's what I thought. So the issue of whether the HPV vaccine should be mandatory has been pretty controversial. It involves public health, parental rights, the appropriate role of the state, sexual activity, pharmaceutical company profits, race, teenagers, a relatively new vaccine, and a lot of other issues that tend to get people worked up. It's not easy. Various organizations have taken positions on whether it should be mandatory, and lots has been written about it. Many states have considered it. I think most states, in fact, have had bills introduced, but most declined to enact mandatory legislation. In Washington, D.C., the outcome was different. It became, and I think remains, one of the maybe only two jurisdictions that require girls to be vaccinated. And in D.C., we require girls to be vaccinated as a condition of entering sixth grade, and that mandate will go into effect in the upcoming school year. My hospital helped to inform the decision that was made by the City Council to enact this legislation, and my goal today is to describe the role that we played and how that decision came about. No disclosures. You all probably know, but I'll review quickly, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommended the HPV vaccine, a series of three injections for girls 11 to 12 years old, but the series could be initiated as early as 9 years, and girls or women 13 to 26 who have not received the vaccines or the complete series could be vaccinated. Ideally, this series is given prior to the initiation of sexual activity, and there is no change in the cervical cancer screening recommendations for girls who have been vaccinated. This is the district building, or the John A. Wilson building in Washington, and it's the seat of the local government where the city council meets and where the mayor has his offices. Children's Hospital in D.C., where I work, is a partner with the Washington, D.C. Department of Health on a number of public health projects ranging from the school nursing program to the healthcare system for children in foster care, and a whole variety of vaccine-related initiatives that are designed to increase the compliance rate of vaccines among preschool and school-age children. The whole issue of our hospital's involvement in the HPV vaccine issue sort of came to us as really a surprise. My boss was testifying at a health committee hearing in the city council, and out of the blue, the chair of the city council, who often says things out of the blue, or at least things that surprise his witnesses, said, "So what's the hospital's position on making the HPV vaccine mandatory?" And we didn't have one. And the Washington Post reported on that, and another city council member was shocked that we weren't in favor of it and that we hadn't taken a position as one of the leading pediatric healthcare providers in the city. And there were a number, actually, of city council members who were asking us to take a position, and Washington Post stories that reported that we hadn't yet to take a position. So we are organized the way many pediatric medical centers are organized. We provide medical care, advocacy, research, and education. And obviously, this falls into our advocacy mission, which is led by our Child Health Advocacy Institute, where I work. And we do a variety of things, and this particular activity falls under the public policy and the health promotion disease prevention area. We have at the hospital what's called the Committee on Advocacy and Public Policy, and that is a governance committee to which we report and serves as and is a board committee, a hospital board committee. It includes board members, community members, and our staff, clinical, legislative, legal, and advocacy. And the job of the Committee on Advocacy and Public Policy is to direct the public policy and advocacy decisions related to our hospital and to children in general. And the deliberations about the hospital's position which ultimately was essentially adopted by the city, took place within this CAP committee for the most part. So the CAP began with commissioning a background paper on the HPV vaccine, which tried to provide lots of information on all sides. I want to read you the introduction to it, and that's that at the time, several states were considering requiring preteen and teenage females to be vaccinated against human papillomavirus, but there have been concerns raised about the vaccine and especially about making it mandatory. Some concerns are the same objections that have been raised for many years with regard to childhood immunizations generally. As an institution with a history of support for mandatory childhood vaccination, we will not address those general concerns here. However, additional concerns specific to the HPV vaccine have been raised, including objections by some who favor its use but oppose making it mandatory. And those issues were the focus of the background paper that the CAP relied on in its deliberations and in making its decisions. So I just want to pull out some of the information from that background paper that I thought was most critical in the CAP's decision-making process. For one thing, the cervical cancer rates in Washington, D.C. and in Maryland, which is also a primary service area for us, are higher than the national average. And I think that that was an important piece of information. Similarly, the youth sexual activity, and particularly the early initiation of sexual activity in Washington, D.C. was important. You recall that one of the recommendations of ACIP was that the vaccines ideally be given prior to the initiation of sexual activity. So if that was going to happen for many girls in D.C., that needed to be when they were pretty young. I also should point out, as I'm sure most of you know, that these data are self-reported and therefore probably understate the prevalence of sexual activity in these groups. Similarly, the teenage birth rate is high in D.C., and it's fluctuated some in the last few years, but it tends to be among the highest or the highest in the nation, and the number of abortions is about equal to the number of teenage birth rates. So again, just the birth rate would understate the issue. The concerns that the CAP primarily had that were captured in this background paper had to do with efficacy, safety, and there was specific discussion of the rotavirus vaccine, the duration of immunity, the cost of the vaccine and who would have access, what other states were doing, what Merck, the pharmaceutical company, was doing, and sort of public knowledge and information about HPV and its link to cervical cancer. So at that time, there were pre-approval studies of more than 11,000 female volunteers, and they found that the vaccine had 100% efficacy in preventing cervical precancers caused by the targeted HPV types, and nearly 100% efficacy in preventing vulvar and vaginal precancers and genital warts caused by the targeted HPV types. The studies were of 5 years' duration, and they found out that the vaccine remained effective during that time, and there was no evidence of waning immunity. There were minor reactions to administration of the vaccine, but in that population of 11,000 volunteers, there had been no serious side effects. We reviewed the data related to the rotavirus vaccines, and I'm sure you all know that about RotaShield and RotaTeq, and that the associations with problems were not detected until after they were already in use, and that was of concern. In terms of the cost, the wholesale cost for this series of three vaccines was thought to be about $360. And there were questions about whether pediatricians would stock it because of the cost, whether it would be available depending on insurance status and those sorts of things. And ultimately, I think the feeling of the committee was that most children in D.C. would have access through their insurance or through a public clinic to the vaccine. There were also concerns about whether it would be consistently available, given that there have been vaccine shortages in other areas, and this was a new vaccine. Parental, oh, I'm sorry, on, on, um, other states. At that time, 33 states had legislation that had been introduced to require, fund, or educate the public about the vaccine. So there was a lot of activity going on. The governor of Texas had issued an executive order making it mandatory, although that was later changed. The Virginia legislature had passed a mandatory HPV vaccine bill, although there is a sort of a big loophole in terms of opting out there. And then in our neighboring state of Maryland, there had been a bill introduced to require the HPV vaccine, but the sponsor had withdrawn it, and in fact the legislature went on to set up a task force to come up with recommendations. On the pharmaceutical company activities, I think some of you who followed this closely will remember that there was a very aggressive lobbying campaign by Merck, the company which developed Gardasil, the vaccine in question, and I think a lot of people received a lot of negative press attention, and the company ultimately pulled back on that. In our case, the CAP decided that the activities of the pharmaceutical company really didn't have much bearing on whether we thought that the vaccine was a good one to be mandatory in the district. In terms of public knowledge, We agreed that there was a fairly low level of understanding about the relationship between HPV and cancer, and that it would be difficult for many parents to accept the vaccine because they didn't fully understand its importance. There were concerns that that parental rights would be violated, and there's always an important dichotomy that needs to be considered between autonomy, in this case parental autonomy of making decisions for a child, versus public health. And we spent a lot of time talking about that. There were religious and other beliefs. Some people felt that this was a behavioral disease, unlike the diseases that most vaccines cover, and that behavioral diseases should not necessarily invoke a mandate for vaccination. And some people felt that mandating the vaccine or even offering the vaccine in effect gave young children permission to have sexual activity. So the issues that I thought in going through the discussion were most decisive for the committee were that the vaccine was safe and efficacious based on the data that were available. The CAP thought that there would be a payment mechanism that would allow the vaccine to be accessible to all, or at least almost all, children in the District of Columbia for whom it was indicated. That the district had a very high rate of very early sexual activity, and that the only opportunity to really vaccinate these children effectively, that is before the initiation of sexual activity, was to have the vaccine in widespread use early. That the district in Maryland had a relatively high rate of cervical cancer. And another issue that was important is that we'd been working, as I mentioned earlier, on a number of preschool and school-age vaccine initiatives with the Department of Health. And prior to some of the more aggressive activities that the Department of Health and others engaged in, the rate of vaccination for school-age children was only about 40% in the District of Columbia. That went up significantly, but what really brought it up to where it stands now, which is in the high 90s, was when the school system began to enforce its mandate that in order to enroll in and attend school, children must be vaccinated. So we came to the conclusion that without a mandate, there'd be relatively little uptake of this vaccine based on our experience with school-age children and other vaccines generally. In terms of the public health versus autonomy argument, the committee thought about the safety helmets, seatbelt laws, many of which have been objected to on the same grounds, and felt that, as I think Dr. Fauci said last night, the horse had already left the barn, that decision was made. And then also talked about the hepatitis B vaccine and that being already a precedent for a different kind of vaccine in the same way that the HPV vaccine was. So the CAT made recommendations that were adopted by the Children's National Medical Center Board of Directors that the HPV vaccine should be mandatory for pre-adolescent and adolescent girls, that the vaccine should be made available immediately to all girls and young women for whom it is indicated, that there needs to be a public education campaign and vaccine funding for vulnerable populations, particularly in communities with a high incidence of cervical cancer, that prior to becoming mandatory in states, it was important that certain things be done, that the states conduct public information campaigns that talked about the issues that I discussed earlier, that there was a continued need for cervical cancer screening through regular pap smears, even in vaccinated children, that the data continuously be monitored for safety and effectiveness of the vaccine, and that policies be modified if the data suggests the need to do that, that there be a funding mechanism so that all girls can have access, that there be an opt-out provision, and that to ensure that the above recommendations are given the necessary time to realize, that there be a window before the mandates were enacted. So the District of Columbia Council shortly thereafter adopted a policy that was largely informed by what the hospital had recommended, that every female child enrolling in sixth grade must receive the HPV vaccine starting in this 2009 school year, unless there's an opt-out. And that there may be an opt-out for any reason. The opt-out provision is different from what it is for other vaccines in the district. That the city would conduct a public education campaign concerning the issues that we discussed, that down the road males would be included consistent with CDC guidelines. There has been some public education, and this was a press release that the Department of Health put out about a series of public education meetings it had on the vaccine. And that's what I have to say, and I'll take any questions if there are some.
Thank you. That was very interesting. I have a question about how this is being operationalized this coming school year. Do you have other immunization mandates for sixth grade?
For sixth grade specifically, no.
But
each year when a child goes to school, he or she needs to present a completed medical examination form and a complete list of vaccines. And the child is by law not permitted to enroll or attend school unless that is done and the vaccines are up to date.
So what about TD or Tdap? Do you have a mandate for that?
Tdap goes into effect in the same, I'm looking at our vaccination, in the 2010 school, what? Tdap is already in effect. I'm sorry. I was looking at our vaccine program. People who know this much better than I. Over a 3-year period. We are implementing a series of new vaccine requirements. So Tdap already is required.
And is that required for seventh grade or
it's
sixth grade?
Required all the way across the board. Thank you.
All the way across.
Yeah. So you have to. If you do not have it at any age for which it is indicated, you cannot enroll in or attend school. As I mentioned earlier, that law has been, and those regulations have been on the books for quite some time, but in the last few years, the school district began to enforce it, and it has been critical in reaching very, very high levels of vaccine compliance among school-age children and in maintaining those levels.
I guess what I'm getting at is when you have a routine adolescent visit for catch up for vaccines or for mandatory vaccines. I mean, I assumed usually it's for seventh grade entry, but it seems now.
Annually, and it's required annually in the District
okay.
of Columbia.
Okay.
Does that, am I answering your?
I think so. Thank
okay.
you. You mentioned the opt out clause for parents, and you know, you said they could opt out for any reason. Could you talk a little bit more about that and whether or not it's impacted on your other vaccines?
Well, no, because the opt-out clause, the final language, it doesn't exist yet. The final language is supposed to be released by the Department of Health this week. The opt-out for the HPV vaccine applies only to the HPV vaccine. It does not provide a greater opt-out provision. We will see down the road if it has any impact on other vaccines.
Thank you to both speakers. Again, on the opt-out, is that a one-time phenomenon, or does it have to be renewed with each year?
I think it probably has to be done once and then left on file with the school after that. And then once it's on file, the child has opted out. The requirement applies only to sixth grade. There is no catch-up requirement. So if you're an eighth grade female next year and you don't have the HPV vaccine, you're okay. So there's no catch-up provision for children for whom the vaccine may be indicated but have gone beyond the sixth grade.
Okay, and if I may, one more. You listed a whole series of reasons that went into the decision. Do you think you might have changed or made a different decision if, let's say, the cervical cancer rates had not been high, or if vaccine compliance had not been low?
In other words, in another jurisdiction with different circumstances, perhaps. I have to say that we tried to develop a policy that could have broader application than the District of Columbia, but we were clearly influenced by the children whom we primarily serve, and the fact of the matter is that there is a very high rate of early initiation of sexual activity and a high rate of preventable diseases, including cervical cancer. So I think that did probably influence the decision. In a different jurisdiction, the decision might have been different. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
I'm Kimberly Frederick from Dwight D. Eisenhower Army Medical Center in Georgia. I just had a question. How effective is the HPV vaccine?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the beginning of the question.
How effective is the HPV vaccine if the three-dose schedule is not followed?
I don't know the answer to that question. Do you?
There's no data.
I don't think that there's
really no data on that yet, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. I think they're collecting that at the pharmaceutical company, but it's not been released.
Yeah.
And Canada is actually doing an efficacy study looking at just providing two doses of the vaccine and how the efficacy of only two doses is. But the jury's still out.
Hi, thank you both for your presentations. I'm Jill Thompson from St. Louis. And one of the questions I had in my mind was, we're in a state that's pretty anti-vaccine, and I'd like your comments and thoughts on one of the reasons some folks have been against a state mandate is because there's been efforts to tie the hands of the State Department of Health in, so they have a broad legislation for school entry, and some folks would like to keep that power with the health department versus the legislative department. And so, I'd just like for comments on that. Am I clear of that situation?
I think so, although I don't know if I have enough information to answer your question. You're saying should the decision-making rest with the legislature or the Department of Public Health?
Right, and particularly in the state of Missouri, you know, there's a real strong anti-vaccine movement that has actually even had one law passed to limit the types of immunizations available.
So in other words, if you allow the public health department to make all of the decisions, the legislature might not make some decisions that would be unwanted.
Right.
Okay. That's probably something that people in Missouri would be in a much better position to answer than I. I think that we all agree, mandatory or not, that we want to have as many vaccines getting to the right people as possible. The political conditions, I'm sure, vary from state to state about how to achieve that. So I think that people who are most familiar with the state would be in a much better position to make that judgment. Anything else?
I just had one question, and perhaps this may be for the people in D.C. In preparing for this mandate and before it's implemented, are you doing any special vaccination clinics or any special activity, since there are three doses involved, to get these girls vaccinated before the start of the school season?
Rosie McLaren is the program manager, the wonderful program manager of our vaccine program in D.C.
No, there are no special events that will be held to bring the number of people class right into school. The question in D.C. is that they need to go to their primary care physician because there are many other things that are needed beyond the immunization. So the question is, you know, the medical thing. So we're relying on the docs to, you know, to, they've all been informed of this new regulation. And this one was in effect last year.
So then do you have something for all those kids that are kicked out September 20th, what they're all going to do? Because when we did the same thing in Ohio, it was the drop dead date of, you know, 3 weeks into the school year, there were still all these non-compliant families, and the kids were not allowed to go to school on whatever the day was. And
Rosie, do you want to, it looks like you want to make a comment.
Well, I just have a related question that I think you may be able to clarify. Is the requirement to have initiated vaccine before starting school, or do they have to complete the three-dose series before starting school?
Well, the requirement says that you have to have the HPV vaccine prior to entry to school. However, if you have one dose, you will not be turned away from school. The idea is that you can complete the series, you know, once you have started it, you can complete it. But you will not be turned away if you have just one dose. And your other question, I'm sorry.
What if I don't have any doses and your date comes?
You will be, well, that has been an issue in the past, even before this particular mandate. And the way the city and the school district have responded is we've had extra vaccination clinics over the summer. We have provided parents with all kinds of opportunities to get their kids vaccinated, but we have usually come down to a few hundred kids out of a school system of 80,000, something like that, where they aren't, and those kids are usually referred to the child welfare agency and kind of get sorted out from there. They ultimately do get vaccinated, but sometimes with, you know, some difficulty in that last very small group.
I know in the school system, they're the ones who really, they're the ones who are responsible for compliance. We really are not involved in that part of the process, but what we have heard is that in the past, they have set kids aside the first day of school. Once they've made the determination, kids are then set aside in a special holding area until the parents come back and inform the parents that the kids are not in compliance, and then the parents, then their responsibility to make sure the kids get their vaccinations. And I think there's, Jackie, if I'm correct, there's a 10-day grace period.
Other questions?
Yeah, what about the opt-out? They just opt out?
They can opt out for this.
So in effect, that's an answer to your question. They can just opt out.
They
can
opt out.
Right, but they have to.
It has to be documented.
Right, they have to take action one way or the other. They can opt out, or they can get the vaccine for the child, but they can't do nothing.
Right.
And can you just explain for your other vaccine requirements, what is the process for exemptions? Is it just a religious or
religious and medical only?
Oh, okay.
No philosophical.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
Have you had a lot of physician backlash? I mean, most physicians don't provide the vaccine. They don't have them. You're a standalone clinic and you don't have the equipment to have the vaccines all stored in the refrigerator and everything. I mean, you have a lot of backlash, you have a lot of physicians, they
not heard that. We've not heard that. Dr. Fu is a physician at Children's. She sees a lot of the kids that are in the DCPS. And have you had any such experience?
No problem with this. I think it comes a lot down to educating providers. So we have a six clinic around the community, and discussing with providers and the other large provider in the city. And so it just comes down to a lot of education.
If I saw a patient and I don't actually carry the vaccine, can I write a script that patients get the vaccine and they can go?
Sure. We Jacqueline Campbell is our nurse specialist. She runs her own clinic in D.C. We had five that were now closed primarily because of the push for the district government to, they have put a lot of money into primary care. And so they're trying to get kids to go to a medical home. So because of that, they've closed the five express clinics that we have, and we only have one. We have been getting a lot of patients recently that whose doctors don't provide the HPV vaccine, so they've been coming to us to get the vaccination.
Well, generally,
they
don't pay.
At our clinic, no.
Yeah, I mean, generally, they don't pay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, well. And before we all leave, I do have some final housekeeping announcements. One is that the lunch rounds will begin at 12 o'clock and in the Austin Ballroom across the Sky Bridge in the hotel. And don't forget that you must have already signed up to attend the lunch rounds, and a colored sticker on your name badge is your ticket into the rounds. And those of you who will not be participating in the lunch round should feel free to visit the Cyber Cafe in CE Room, which is located in the Lone Star Ballroom A3, which I think is right here, or the exhibits in the Grand Hall. Posters are also available for viewing during the lunch break. And if you want to apply for continuing education credits, please do not wait until the conclusion of the conference to complete the evaluations for all the sessions you've attended. And I encourage you to stop by the CE Room to complete your online continuing education evaluations after each session. Remember to stop by the conference registration desk if you need a printed receipt for your registration fee. Receipts will also be available for printing on the internet after the conference. And finally, the next session will begin promptly at 2 p.m. Please see pages 21 and 22 of your agenda books for detailed information. And thank you again. And I want to also thank our presenters as well. Thank you.